Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to give you that shortcut to being well-informed, digging into complex sources, and pulling out what you really need to know.
And today, we're jumping into a really fascinating area of textual analysis.
We are. We're looking at something called backdated prophecy, specifically within Joseph Smith's foundational texts for early Mormonism. We're looking for what you might call literary fingerprints.
It's one of the most powerful tools a textual critic has. So a backdated prophecy, just so we're all on the same page, is a literary technique. It's where a writer records events that have already happened.
Things they already know.
Right. But they frame them as these ancient miraculous predictions. They put the words, you know, into the mouth of a prophet who lived centuries earlier.
So to be clear, our mission today isn't about theology. It's about treating these texts like any other historical document and trying to figure out when they were written based on the knowledge they contain. What are these fingerprints we're looking for?
We're looking for the author's shadow, really. The key pattern is a sudden, very distinct shift. Where a text is describing history that the author already knows, the prophecy is incredibly specific, incredibly accurate.
Okay.
But the second it tries to predict the actual unknown future, the prophecy just becomes vague or generalized or, you know, just plain wrong. That tipping point, that's what tells you when the author was actually writing.
Before we apply that to our main sources, we should probably set up a baseline. I know scholars use a kind of gold standard for this method, right?
They do, and it's almost always the Old Testament's Book of Daniel.
The Book of Daniel, right.
It's the perfect case study. If you look at chapter 11, for instance, it claims to be this huge sweep of history. We're talking about 400 years. From the 6th century BCE all the way down to the 2nd century BCE.
And for most of that time, it's spot on.
It's remarkably accurate. It details specific battles, shifting alliances, the rise and fall of these Hellenistic kings. I mean, the detail is just impeccable.
400 years of flawless predictions. That sounds pretty impressive on its face. But where does it start to unravel?
It unravels with surgical precision. Right around 168 or 167 BCE, up to that point, everything is perfect. It describes the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, the king of the north and king of the south.
And then
the text tries to predict what will happen next to the ruler at that exact moment, a man named Antiochus Epiphanes.
What does Daniel predict for him that doesn't actually happen?
Well, it predicts Antiochus would wage a second successful war against Egypt and, crucially, that he would die in Judea.
And from history, we know.
We know neither of those things happened. Antiochus died pretty peacefully in Persia, miles and miles away from Judea. The second campaign it never happened as predicted.
So that's the fingerprint.
Yeah.
The author knew everything that happened up to 168 BCE, but knew nothing after. So that little window is when the text was actually written.
Exactly. It's a historical timestamp embedded right in the text. And we can use that exact same lens, hyperspecificity, followed by sudden error on our sources today.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. Let's start with a foundational event. The Charles Anthon visit in 1828. Martin Harris takes these character transcriptions to a professor in New York City. It's got two different accounts, and they show a pretty clear evolution.
Yes, you have to contrast the 1832 history, which is the earliest one we have, with the much later 1838 history.
And the first one is pretty simple.
It's very simple. You could call it bare bones. Harris goes to the learned man. The man says he can't read the characters. And Joseph Smith immediately says, look, this fulfills Isaiah chapter 29, the sealed book delivered to the unlearned.
Simple, direct. But by 1838, the story gets a major polish.
A dramatic one. And it's important to remember the 1838 version is written years later after Martin Harris had actually been excommunicated. He's no longer an internal witness they can control.
So the story gets bigger.
Much bigger. The new version claims Anthon looked at the translation and declared it was correct, more so than any he had seen before translated from the Egyptian.
Which is a pretty incredible claim. How could anyone at that time verify a translation of a language, reformed Egyptian, that only one person on earth claimed to be able to read?
That's the inconsistency that raises a huge red flag. It gets stranger. The news story claims Anthon identified the characters as a mix of four languages, Egyptian, Chaldaic, Assyric, and Arabic.
Which doesn't make much sense if the plates were supposed to be written in one language.
Exactly. But we have physical evidence of the backdating here, too, a literal clue in the manuscript.
In different ink?
In darker ink, yes. Textual analysis shows that the most crucial line, the one that perfectly fulfills the prophecy, Anthon supposedly saying, "I cannot read a sealed book," was added into the 1838 draft later. It's clear physical proof of an intentional, after-the-fact edit.
And there's that detail about a written certificate that gets torn up. That's also new in the 1838 version, and it seems to be borrowed from a later, more successful event in Joseph Smith's life.
It really mirrors the Michael Chantler experience from 1835 with the Book of Abraham Papyri. In that case, Joseph Smith actually did get a signed statement. So it looks like the author took a successful event from 1835 and retroactively inserted a similar detail, the certificate, into the 1828 story to make it more powerful.
So a later success becomes the template for rewriting an earlier, less dramatic event. That shows a constant evolution of the narrative.
A continuous revision of the past.
Let's shift to maybe the biggest crisis of the early church. The loss of the first 116 pages of the Book of Mormon manuscript, the Book of Lehi. This problem required a backdated solution.
This was an existential threat. I mean, think about it. If he just retranslates the lost pages, his critics, who have the original copy...
They could change a few words and expose him.
Instantly.
Yeah.
His credibility would be gone. So he needed a narrative device that didn't just replace the content, but made the loss itself part of God's plan from the very beginning.
And how did he do that? Where does this backdating show up?
Well, we have pretty clear evidence that he dictated the main body of the book, First Mosiah through Moroni. It was only after losing the 116 pages that he went back and wrote the beginning, what we now call 1 Nephi.
The famous small plates of Nephi.
Precisely. The solution gets backdated into the part of the text he wrote last. So in the current story, 1 Nephi chapter 9, it says the Lord prepared a smaller second set of plates 2,400 years in advance.
Specifically to deal with his future problem.
Exactly. It's a coy hint, as scholars put it, that the plates were there to compensate for the lost pages. The author wove the solution to his 1828 crisis into the ancient story.
But the contradiction really stands out when you look at the revelation Joseph Smith received at the time of the loss.
That's the giveaway. The revelation in Doctrine and Covenants section 10. It says nothing about small plates, not a word. It tells Joseph to translate from the larger, unabridged plates of Nephi. The small plates idea only shows up later, after the decision was made to rewrite the beginning.
And if we apply our Daniel principle, that test of specific versus vague predictions, the order he wrote the book in becomes even clearer, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The prophets in the replacement section, the part he wrote last, 1 Nephi, make these unbelievably specific prophecies. Like, Jesus will be born exactly 600 years after Lehi leaves Jerusalem.
But the prophets in the middle section.
The part we know he wrote first, Alma, Mosiah, they speak about Christ's coming in very general, vague terms. They say things like, not far distant, or we know not how soon.
The author is betraying himself. The person writing 1 Nephi already knows the whole story, including the 600-year timeline that comes later. But the person writing the middle part first was still working without that fixed date.
It's a powerful internal clue. It strongly suggests the end of the narrative was written first, fixing the key events in place, and then the author went back and backdated those specific details into the beginning's prophecy.
Okay, let's zoom out one last time and apply that same Daniel method to the entire Book of Mormon to see if we can date the whole text to the 19th century.
Right. We can start with Nephi's vision in 1 Nephi chapter 13. The prophecy is incredibly detailed and perfectly accurate for American history right up to Joseph Smith's time.
And then it just stops.
It just stops. Nephi sees Columbus arriving in 1492, the white settlers taking land from the Native Americans, even the Revolutionary War. The detail is amazing right up until the 1820s.
Which is the author's own knowledge just bleeding through into the text. It's too specific to be ancient, and it stops right when he was writing.
Absolutely. And you also see clear self-insertion. Joseph Smith runs a prophecy about himself in 2 Nephi chapter 3.
About a Joseph, son of Joseph.
A seer, yes. And he's so committed to this idea that he inserts almost the same prophecy into his later translation of Genesis. The author is literally writing himself into ancient scripture.
And the author's limitations, his own knowledge, also seem to betray a 19th century origin.
They do. When the text makes errors in biblical scholarship, like confusing John the Apostle with John of Revelation, or thinking Paul wrote the book of Hebrews, those aren't just random mistakes.
They're the common mistakes of his time.
They perfectly match the common scholarly consensus and, frankly, the errors that were prevalent among American Protestants in the 1820s. An ancient prophet wouldn't inherit the specific academic blind spots of upstate New York.
So we've talked about what's in the book. Let's flip that. What's missing? The book claims to be the fullness of the gospel, but it's completely silent on major doctrines that Joseph Smith developed just a few years later.
The omissions are maybe the most powerful chronological fingerprint of all. If this book is the fullness of the gospel, how can it be totally unaware of the core theology that became central to the church in the 1830s and 40s?
So it's not there.
Well, there's zero mention of temple marriage for exaltation, baptism for the dead, celestial marriage, the word of wisdom, or even the priesthood offices that developed later. And maybe most importantly, it has no idea that the Garden of Eden was supposed to be in Jackson County, Missouri.
That is a huge gap. If your founding text is silent on your most fundamental temple rituals and the location of Eden, it suggests the author just hadn't come up with those ideas yet.
That's the conclusion textual critics come to. When you combine the hyper-specific details that stop in 1829 and the complete absence of every major doctrine invented after 1829, you can date the text to the 19th century with a very, very high degree of certainty.
Those are the author's signatures.
And when we put this all together, we see that backdating isn't just a literary trick. It's a really profound tool for establishing and protecting the author's authority.
And you can see that so clearly in the famous Moroni prophecy. It was supposedly given to Joseph in 1823, but wasn't written down until 1838. It says his name would be known for good and evil among all nations.
The psychological strategy there is just fascinating. By including the idea that his name would be spoken of for evil, Joseph Smith created what some scholars call a thought-terminating cliché.
Meaning what? For a believer, how does that work?
It means that every time criticism comes up, historical scrutiny, textual analysis, evidence like what we've talked about today, it gets neutralized on the spot. A believer doesn't see it as a threat to their faith.
They see it as proof.
They see it as direct, fulfilling proof that the original prophecy came true. The evidence for fraud becomes the evidence for prophecy.
A truly effective shield against any future scrutiny. It's a powerful reminder that sometimes the best prophecy is one that accounts for its own criticism. We encourage you to look at these sources for yourself. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.